So as our moderator was so generous enough to describe, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how my team was able to use electronic health records to evaluate NAFLD and NASH. That's how I'm going to refer to them for the rest of the presentation. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to walk you through some of the basics of the epidemiology of these two diseases, and then I'm going to talk to you about PCIP, or Primary Care Information Project, which is the bureau at the New York City Department of Health that houses the hub, and kind of how we are able to use the hub to extract data from our practices and learn a little bit more about how certain diseases are being documented. And then I'll review the results of our analysis and the conclusions we were able to make. So the first thing you need to understand about NAFLD and NASH is that it exists on a fatty liver disease spectrum. So the spectrum really is defined by or marked by increasing levels of steatosis or lipid accumulation in the liver cells. So and all of this is marked by non-alcoholic reasons, which isn't able to be identified through actual biology, but rather just patient history. So both NAFLD and NASH can lead to mortality through cirrhosis or hepatocellular carcinoma, along with other unexplained pathogenesis in metabolic syndrome and multimorbidity. The diagnosis of NAFLD is fairly complicated, as is, and even more so for NASH, because it requires a liver biopsy to be completely certain that the patient has it. But typically, a lot of hospitals will use their imaging techniques, including an ultrasound, to identify the disease. Oftentimes, the initial diagnosis is started by identifying elevated levels of liver enzymes, such as the AST-ALT ratio or serine aminotransferase levels. But this can also be a result of other types of diseases like hepatitis C, and so it's not a conclusive method for diagnosis. So just out of curiosity, does anyone in this room know what the percentage of, what the projected prevalence of NAFLD is in the country, in the United States, amongst adults? Hi. Well, I would think so. I would agree. So right now, epidemiologists have estimated that 1 in 3 U.S. adults have NAFLD, which is very high, given that I imagine most people don't actually know what NAFLD even stands for. So the problem is that because diagnosis is so difficult, we have a range of prevalence estimates across different populations, going from 27% to 34%. And NASH is even harder to hone in on terms of prevalence, and so the estimates are definitely a lot smaller, 2 to 5%, but that's not necessarily exact. We do know that in populations that have the comorbid conditions of NAFLD and NASH, which include obesity and type 2 diabetes, or basically any other disease that is strongly linked with the metabolic syndrome, you see much higher prevalence of these two diseases. So it definitely has a huge impact in America. There is a multitude of research that's trying to identify high-risk populations. And what's really strongly been identified is that Hispanics and Asians are at high risk, and middle-aged individuals from 40 to 59 are also at high risk. But less is understood about what who is at, which sex is at a higher risk, and there's absolutely no literature on the impact of socioeconomic factors unless they are trying to extrapolate from our understanding of the influence of socioeconomic factors in the comorbid conditions like obesity and type 2 diabetes. So I work at PCIP, the Primary Care Information Project at the DOH, and it was founded with this mission of helping New York City ambulatory practices and providers obtain an electronic health record and use it meaningfully, which were the meaningful use attestation that guidelines that were set by the government. And so we've been doing this for a long time, and what what this has led to is not only just in New York City, but all across the nation, we've seen that the use of electronic health records has almost quadrupled, or more than quadrupled, since 2001. And what this means is that data that was previously sitting in paper records, we can now actually leverage and create actionable data reports, maps, dashboards that inform provider performance, clinical research, and health policy. So within PCIP, we are able to, we have helped certain practices that have used a specific electronic health record vendor called eClinicalWorks to collaborate with us so we can pull data from their EMRs. So how does this work exactly? Well, I'm a Lord of the Rings fan, so let's say you have patient Gandalf who's going to the Shire practice, and he's going to see his provider, Dr. Elrond. Now, the Shire practice and Dr. Elrond are one of many PCIP practices, but not only are they do they work with us, but they also happen to use a specific electronic health record called eClinicalWorks, the one I mentioned. And because they use that vendor, we have collaborated with that vendor to generate the hub, which is a querying system. So what that means is we can develop a question at PCIP. Let's say, how many diabetics are there at each of these practices between the ages of 40 and 59? And we translate this question into a query that we run across the practice servers. And in return, the practices give us aggregate count data. So what that means is we're not going to see Gandalf's information. It's not line level data from each patient, but rather Gandalf is going to contribute if he counts for the question we asked. So if he has diabetes and is in between the ages of 40 and 59, he will be included in that count. So that's how the hub kind of works. And so we have an expansive coverage in New York City. The map you see on the right is a map of the penetration we have in New York City. And you can see in some neighborhoods, we see up to 1 in 2 New York City residents walking through the PCIP practice, PCIP hub practices. So that's an expansive number of people. It came out to be about 2 million people in 2014 that we can analyze data from. And all of the yellow dots indicate locations where our practices are, and you can see that that expands over all 5 boroughs in New York City. And these practices are a range of types, from community health centers to hospital clinics, but the vast majority of them are independent practices. So let's talk a little bit about how we pulled the data, but then what exactly did we do when we were pulling the data? Well, so we formulated the question that we wanted to see documentation of NAFLD and NASH by certain patient characteristics like poverty, age, sex, and race. And we ran this over all the hub practices and got full sets of data from 507 practices. Then, because I was interested in looking at the trend over time from 2011 and 2014, we wanted to make sure we were looking at a cohort of practices that were identified as good documenters from this time period. In previous studies, we've been able to evaluate where a provider can be documenting in a record that identifies them as using the record meaningfully and well. So from 507, we went to 396 practices, but that still amassed over 800,000 patients that we were looking at in 2014. So we queried the ICD-9 code that has NAFLD and NASH combined. That was just a functionality of what was available. The ICD-10 code, it might be interesting to note, actually separates the two, but we weren't able to use it at that time, of the time of the study. We evaluated the sample makeup across the years to get a sense of how this changed over time in each of the years. While the practice cohort was consistent, we understand that the patient groups could be different across this time period. And then we graphed both the percent of cases and cases per 100,000 from each of these years. tested the normality of the data, which we identified was skewed. So we chose to use Wilcox and Rank Sum test to evaluate whether there was a significant difference from 2011 to 2014 in the rate of documentation. So what were our results? So I described that our first step was to look at the descriptive statistics of our sample, and because the cohort was kept the same over across 2011 through 2014, this set of statistics apply for each year, and you can see the majority of our practices were small practices or independent practices. But we did have some community health centers and hospital clinics and foster care agencies that were contributing to our case count. Now, while the practice cohort, like I mentioned, was kept consistent across the time, over the years, obviously there's a change in the patient sample over the years, and so we see a significant increase over time, which is why we looked at the rates instead of just case documented case count. Overall, though, the actual percentage makeup of each of this population over the study period was relatively consistent, with the exception of race. You can see that amongst whites and missing, there was some definite shifts, but other than that, the practice makeup was relatively consistent. And the big major thing we identified was that if you looked at 2014, right now, at the lowest estimated prevalence of NAFLD, as deemed by many epidemiological researchers, we're expecting 24% of the patients to have documentation of this disease. What we actually see is less than 1% are being documented in this system. So there's a major difference there. Over time, however, there was a statistically significant increase over in the study sample of cases per 100,000 patients of NAFLD and NASH. It actually doubled over time. And we see this trend consistently across some practice and patient characteristics. So this graph right here is looking at the trend by year and practice type. And we see the same doubling happening in community health center, both independent practices and hospitals, which is interesting because at the hospital clinic, you would assume that the rates would definitely be high of documentation because they may be closely linked with the hospital where the diagnosis is actually happening. But instead, what we're seeing is the rate of increase is the same regardless of whether it's in a hospital or independent practice. Community health centers also had a significant increase, but it wasn't as high as we see in hospitals and independent practices, and there weren't any case contributions from foster care agencies, predominantly because we were looking at adults. When we broke it out by the primary care profile of the practices, we didn't see a significant difference whether the practice was primary care or not, but there was a significant increase over time in both of these groups. Again, a doubling. When we looked at age, now remember, I had mentioned that individuals between the age of 40 and 59 are at higher risk, and what we see here is that the highest increase is happening in this, highest increase of documentation is happening in this age group. However, increases happened in all age groups, and they were statistically significant from 2011 to 2014 and roughly represented the same doubling. However, you can see in the younger age group, there was a more moderate increase. Again, like I mentioned, we expected to see high documentation rates amongst Asians and Hispanics, and that's replicated here in the data. What's interesting, though, by looking at it at by race, is that we see that there's not the same linear trend upward that we saw in some of the other patient characteristic breakouts. There's still some variation, especially amongst Asians, from 2013 to 2014. And it's kind of unclear what is causing this drop-off because we don't see consistently across all race groups. So it's something that's worth exploring, but we have limited information to actually inform on what is causing this difference. However, we still see that the highest increase happened amongst Hispanics, and there was a statistically significant increase in across all race groups, with the exception of missing. So with sex, the literature is a little bit more convoluted. There's not a real clear definition of whether females or males are at higher risk for NAFLD. It depends on the population and comorbidities. In this particular sample, we seem to see a higher documentation rate amongst males, and yet still there was a statistically significant increase in both groups, and it was approximately the same rate of increase. So in the electronic health records, we don't have exact variable for socioeconomic status. So we have something called poverty group, which actually reflects the percent of individuals in the neighborhood living below 100% of the federal poverty level. And there are four groups: less than 10%, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, and 30% and higher. There isn't a lot of literature, again, like I mentioned, linking socioeconomic status with NAFLD, unless you're talking about its relationship with its comorbid conditions. However, we did see that in the lower poverty groups, that represent higher percentage of individuals living below the poverty level, we saw more significant, higher increases happening, and there was a significant increase across all poverty groups. So in conclusion, there's definitely a dramatic underdocumentation of NAFLD and NASH compared to what we expect to see, the estimated prevalence, which technically could even be larger than 30% if people are diagnosing NAFLD and NASH, if epidemiologists are correct in saying that the two prevalences are distinct. But what we did see is that documentation has doubled over the years. It's unclear exactly why this is, whether it's because of an increase of cases, improvements in diagnosis, or just a feature of documenting NAFLD better over time. But what we did see was the largest increases in documentation correlate with populations at higher risk of NAFLD, which may suggest that we are seeing increases that are related to the increases in the natural increases in NAFLD that we might expect with the increases of metabolic syndrome and obesity and type 2 diabetes. What is definitely known is that there are many barriers to documenting and diagnosis, and all of these require further exploration across the country, because right now it's unclear the role NAFLD and NASH plays in complicating multimorbidity, and more research is trying to be done to investigate this more thoroughly, and it won't be able to be as effective if we're not documenting and diagnosing it well. There are some limitations to the hub data. We are only as good at the provider documentation, which is why we applied the inclusion criteria to be evaluating good provider documenters. We can't eliminate or account for the patients that visit multiple practices across our study sample, although we have no reason to believe that this is very high. We're also limited in how we can actually look at these different features. There's a limited runtime on the query questions that we can run, so I wasn't able to look at all of the comorbid conditions along with these patient characteristics simultaneously, which brings me to some of the next steps of this project, which is to look at the overlap of type 2 diabetes and obesity or high BMI with NAFLD and NASH. And hopefully we can look at NAFLD alone with the new ICD-10 code and evaluate some of the same patient characteristics with these two features included. So thank you so much for your time, and I think we have like a minute for maybe one question. Yes. Yes, I'm definitely planning on doing some more advanced modeling and applying that. Just haven't gotten to that step yet, to see if maybe these characteristics in a combined model are showing a bigger picture here of how they interact together. But yes, thank you. Yeah, that's definitely a great next step. Yes.
Practitioners or practitioners as part of
That's a really interesting thought. That would be really great, especially because diet and exercise are probably the best treatment options available to patients with NAFLD and NASH. Some of the limitations might be that we can't really capture some of that information in an electronic health record, but in terms of informing them about the results of this research and maybe identifying some areas that are worth exploring, we could definitely reach out. Oh, okay, great. I'm sorry, can you repeat what you were saying about the nutritional codes?
You can look at the nutritional codes or the nutritional references as a positive
comorbidity. I see. And that would be especially helpful in the multivariable analysis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, that's definitely something I want to consider. Anything else?
Arthi, I have a question. So when you analyzed the data, you looked for the ICD-10 codes of the actual diagnosis.
ICD-9 codes.
The ICD-9 codes of the actual diagnosis.
Yes.
Now, what are the diagnostics? Are there ICD-9 codes for those?
Well, so there are lab tests, LOIN codes, mm-hmm. for the lab tests of elevated liver enzymes, mm-hmm. and that might be a potential next step, but prior to doing that study, we would have to see whether those codes were being documented well.
Got it.
And so that was like two steps kind of ahead of what we were trying to examine. But yes, diagnostic could be another area of exploration for the study.
Yes, because it's like, it's exploring, if you're definitely looking at the codes, it's exploring the actual diagnosis and then the things that have led to that.
Sure.
So sometimes there may be a gap, you know, this is human error,
yeah.
something happened along the way. So
mm-hmm.
maybe that could actually, if there's a way you can do that, it could actually see a more true prevalence rate.
Absolutely. I mean, it would be very interesting. I just want to make a note, though, that first off, the really official, verifiable methods aren't going to be happening in ambulatory practices. So that's one limitation of our data to identify the true diagnostics that are happening in the city. In addition to that, actually, with respect to the liver enzyme levels, it could indicate we could see higher diagnostics artificially because those tests and those test results are actually a result of some other disease or mm-hmm. liver damage that's happening that's contributed to it, which is why liver enzyme tests are usually like an initial diagnostic process to lead to the other more verifiable methods. But yes, it's still worth exploring and it could expand this rate. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.